Neve Solicitors are proud to sponsor The Parent Show. The friendly team at Neve's includes specialists who can guide you through all the legal ups and downs of family life. Visit nevesolicitors.co.uk. Neve Solicitors, your complete legal solution.
Welcome to The Parent Show on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM. I'm Lydia El-Khoury.
And I'm Cathy Weston.
Now, tonight on the show, we're going to talk to the Joint Lead Assessment Advisor at Hearts for Learning in Stevenage. Now, the reason why we've brought him into the show is his name is Ben Fuller, and we're going to talk about assessment and assessing our children.
Yeah, basically the theme of tonight's show is we're trying to explore a little bit more about how schools actually approach assessment, how they assess our children, when do they actually do it, what do we parents sort of need to know. It's quite a sort of a difficult area for parents to get their head around, and it's often very much in the headlines, changing assessments or introducing assessments at age four, etc. So we're trying to get a handle on it, and we've had a lot of contributions tonight which have fed into the show from parents, and we're going to be reading out a few of their views as we go on later in the show.
So the first guest this evening is Ben Fuller, who's the Joint Lead Assessment Advisor at Hearts for Learning in Stevenage. Thanks for joining us, Ben.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us, Ben. We've got lots and lots of questions for you, as you can imagine, on this topic. But we'll kick off with a fundamental one. When do our children get assessed? Is it primary, secondary? And at what stages do schools actually take assessment on board?
Okay, well, it's probably useful to explain that assessment can take many different forms and can mean different things to different people. So in one sense, the answer to that question is schools will be assessing children all the time, because every time a teacher notices something about the way a child is approaching a piece of learning, that is assessment. Every time a teacher marks a piece of work, for example, that's all assessment. But I guess perhaps what's behind that question might be thinking more about the more formal aspects of assessment, sort of tests and those sorts of things.
That's right, because I think there has been a lot in the press generally about children's well-being nationally. You know, we don't seem to score very well. You know, they seem to be very stressed out about things like exams. So I think it's on parents' radar to sort of monitor how much pressure they're under at school and when they are being tested.
Yeah. I mean, the first time that a really high-stakes test is sat by children is really the end of Key Stage 2, the end of primary school. But they will have taken tests before that point in time, but they aren't quite as high-stakes in as much as the way those results are used. But children are being assessed all the time. So, for example, in the early years foundation stage, teachers are making assessments, but those are more based on observation of how children are interacting in various different activities, and talking to the children, asking them questions, that sort of thing. So that's more informal. There are tests which are used in Key Stage 1. There's a phonics test which children take at the end of Year 1. But these are not supposed to be stressing children out. I think it can be down to a school in how they administer them, but hopefully they can be administered in a way that they're supposed to be just giving the teacher some information about how the child is doing, but not in such a way that should be causing the children any undue stress.
Well, Ben, let's talk about the big one, the SATS tests.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's parents listening whose children are sitting it. It's in May, June time, I think, the first, this
it's
round.
It's a particular week in May, yes.
Okay.
For year six children, yep.
Okay, so what approach should parents take for those? We often hear in Hertfordshire that parents are coaching or paying for tuition to get children through the SATs. So we'll talk a little bit about the preparation for the SATs first of all.
Okay.
And then actually what teachers do with the data.
Okay. So firstly, I would say that in terms of preparation, my advice to any parent would be talk to the school and find out what the school feels would be in the best interests for that particular child, because the school may be able to say, You know, we're particularly working on this particular aspect of maths, for example, and any help you can do at home in helping them get the hang of this concept might be useful. But I think it's important to say that I would be urging people to say that as much as possible, try not to build up any anxiety amongst the children. So don't necessarily keep sort of saying, right, it's 1 week till SATs, you know, one day to go. You know, the more pressure, the more anxiety, the harder it might be for children to perform to their best. But as I say, schools will have different ways that they prepare children for the tests. So parents should talk to the teachers or talk to the head teacher to find out how they can best help.
Now, Ben, just say any of our listeners are unfortunate enough to have a school where perhaps they can't get the kind of guidance that they're looking for. Is there a second resource, any other alternatives to that? I mean, Hertfordshire is bursting with excellent schools, but just in case.
Well, there are various resources out there, and that, you know, for example, it is possible to go onto the internet and get hold of previous SATs papers and things like that. But I would actually advise against going down that route, because it may be that the school is wanting to use some of those resources in its own preparation of the children, and if the children have already seen some tests which the school was hoping to use, it's going to mess up the procedure, if you see what I mean. So ideally, I think, number one, try not to stress the children out, but focus on them. It's all about them just doing their best, trying their hardest, but not worrying too much if there are questions that they don't understand.
Ben, fundamental question. Someone's just texted to ask, what does SAT stand for?
Okay, well, the SATs is what we tend to call the tests. I mean, actually, it's not their proper name, but we tend to call them SATs, which stands for, well, it either stands for statutory assessment tasks or standard assessment tasks, one of those. But in actual fact, that's not their official name. They're actually just referred to as the Key Stage 2 tests. But the media and everyone calls them SATs, so we tend to have them referred to as SATs. But that's basically what they are. They are that the Year 6 SATs are a test which is set by an external testing agency. So they arrive in the school. The teachers have no idea what the content of the tests is going to be. They're only opened up on that morning. The children do the test. So whereas, as I said earlier, some assessment is a lot more informal. Teachers use assessment to inform their own understanding, their own judgments about the children. The SATs tests are formal, and they're done on that day, and then they're whisked away and marked externally.
Are there any formal tests that take place, or any formal kind of assessments that happen that are not necessarily disclosed to parents, or is it all pretty much, you know, is it pretty much SATs and the end? I think you said the end of Key Stage 2, and there's the Key Stage 1 test.
Yeah. Now, tests are used as part of the Key Stage 1 assessment, but what the teachers actually, the statutory requirement at Key Stage 1 is that teachers make a teacher assessment judgment, which is based on their whole knowledge of how the child performs in everyday situations, plus how they've done in a particular test. So what they will be reporting to the parents is how is what their teacher assessment is. Parents might want to know how their child performed in the test, and you can ask that question, but actually the message we're always saying to teachers is that's really not the be-all and end-all at Key Stage 1. And it's the tests are administered in a very different way to Key Stage 2, so it's not about all the children taking the tests at the same time. They might be administered in small groups. They might be spread out over a period of time. At Key Stage 1, they're supposed to be used in a way that the children really aren't going to feel that this is a strange and pressurised situation.
But I agree with what you say, Ben, about not stressing them out Absolutely, at any point. And I'm sure no parent wants that, and I'm sure no teacher wants that. But I think it does happen. I mean, I know, for example, the Key Stage 1, that's the phonics test, isn't it? I mean...
The phonics test takes place at the end of year one.
At the end of year one, I beg your pardon. And, I mean, that has kind of morphed into a test of what kids... What are the wrong answers rather than what are the right answers, as far as I've understood. Quite often, children are being taught how to identify, are being taught to learn off by heart regularly occurring made-up words to pass this test, you know, which...
Well, that really wouldn't work, I don't think, as a strategy, trying to learn words, because you don't know what's going to come up. And as you say, the words that come up will be a mixture of real words and alien words, made-up words. And the purpose of the test is really to see whether children can use their understanding of phonics, which basically means do they know the sounds that different letters or combinations of letters make. So can they use that skill to blend letters together and say a word? Now, it's absolutely not supposed to be a high-pressure situation. It really doesn't blight the child's life if they don't reach the expected standard. It's really there just to be a piece of information for the school to think about who are the children who perhaps need a little bit more support in their learning. And if they haven't reached the standard in year one, they are expected to have a bit more support in year two, and then that test, they will take that test again, not the same test, but the next year's test at the end of year two. So actually trying to learn different words will in no way help a child approach this test. What will help them is practicing the skill of using phonics.
And it makes, I mean, I understand that schools need some kind of standards to compare children. Otherwise, where would you even begin? There has to be some kind of level of assessment, doesn't there?
Absolutely. I mean, this phonics test, I'm referring to it as a test. The official title of it actually is the phonics screening check, but most people think of it as a test. And this was only introduced 2 years ago because the government felt there needed to be some kind of a national check so that schools could be benchmarked, if you like, on how children are doing. But that data isn't used in a high-stakes way, in the same way that, for example, Key Stage 2 results are used in performance tables. The phonics data isn't used in that way. It's really just there so that the school can see who are the children who need a bit more support.
So, Ben, in the run-up to the SATs, is it true, as I'm gathering from what you're saying, that a lot of data, of information, of observational material, plus the SATs result, shapes up the information that is passed on to potential secondary school?
That approach is what's used at Key Stage 1, 7-year-olds, where it's a teacher assessment based on a whole range of things, including a test. At Key Stage 2, the tests, the reading test, maths test, and there's a grammar, punctuation, and spelling test, those are in isolation, if you like. They are just test results as they stand. And those results will be reported to parents and go up to the secondary school. There's also an assessment of writing, which is a teacher assessment. So that is based on the work that children have been doing and any written work they've been doing across year six, really. So that's a broader assessment built up over time.
And really, it sounds like they value greatly, I don't know because I don't have a child that age, but they really value the maths, they value the English, they value the comprehension and the literacy much more than, and I mean, you know, other skills or other subjects.
Those core subject areas of English and maths are the ones which are assessed a lot more rigorously than other subject areas. That's not to say that other subject areas aren't valued, but certainly... in terms of the data that is reported about schools in the National League tables, yes, it's about those core subjects of English right. and maths.
Okay. Now, coming on to something which we had certainly never heard of until when we started sort of researching this show, and that's the subject of CAP tests.
Okay.
Many listeners, most probably, will have never have heard of them, but some parents of older children in secondary school have written to us about these particular tests with questions for yeah. you, Ben. So the first parent, I'm just going to read out what she's written, if that's okay.
Sure.
She says, I believe teachers may have had access to SATS results prior to school entry, and these results were used to determine banding and streaming. The CATS results were referred to at the first secondary school parents' evening to showcase the fact that my daughter was considered to be very bright, but, quote, taking it easy and coasting.
Right.
And now she's obviously was alarmed to think, what is this CAP test?
Okay.
And how have they sort of reached that conclusion?
Okay, so a CAT test, CAT stands for Cognitive Ability Test. And yes, lots of secondary schools do use them, and they are typically used quite early on in year seven when the children are just starting at secondary school. CAT tests are commercially produced by a company called NFER. There may be other companies that produce them. So this is a test which schools can buy in and use. There's no requirement on them to use these, but many do because they feel it gives them a different insight into the way that child thinks. As I say, it's cognitive ability. So it explores things like their verbal reasoning skills and their non-verbal reasoning skills, sort of logical thinking kind of a test. So yes, the secondary schools will have information from the primary schools about how the children did in the Key Stage 2 SATs and their teacher assessments, but they may also use these CAT tests, and it's then up to the secondary school how it uses that information, and different schools might use that information in different ways.
Now, just on that point, because another parent emailed us with this, he said that his son scored higher than many boys in his SATs, but on talking to the teacher, it was clear that the reason he was put in the bottom set was the CATS test, in which he scored very poorly. There was no doubt in my mind, said this parent, that the school was using these not just for information and guidance, as they said, but deterministically, that the score was deemed more important than other evidence. Is that the sort of correct use of the CAT data?
Well, CATS tests shouldn't be used in a deterministic way. They shouldn't be used as a predictor, if you like.
Yeah.
They indicate at that particular moment in time what that child's cognitive abilities and different strengths might be. They can be really useful for diagnosing where a child may have a particular barrier to their learning. You know, for example, if a child scored very highly on non-verbal reasoning but scored very low on verbal reasoning, that would indicate a particular profile, and the school would then be thinking about how they could best address that child's needs. But I think that, as I say, it will vary in different schools as to how the information is used. And as I said previously, really, I think any parent with concerns should try and talk to the teachers about that and see if they can explain the decisions they've made about which set their child is in.
And lastly, Ben, is it legitimate or acceptable or appropriate for a parent to approach the school and say, I'd like to see my son's CAT data. I'd like to know how he did. You know, can we have access to that information, and should we?
Yes, I think it's perfectly appropriate for a parent to ask for that information. It would need some explanation, probably, that the scores in the range of different parts that make up the test would need to be interpreted in terms of what is a kind of a standard score, what's an above average score, what's a below average score. But parents should absolutely, if they have any concerns or they want to have a greater understanding of these tests should talk to the school, and they should be able to explain how their child performed in that test.
Brilliant. And we've one more question about someone's asked about independent schools. What you've mentioned in the show tonight, does that apply to all schools in general?
What I've been talking about in terms of things like KISA 2, SATs and those sorts of things actually don't apply to independent schools, although independent schools can choose to take part in those assessments, but they don't have to. So that would probably vary from one school to another as to whether they choose to participate in them.
So that's quite an interesting point, because the implication is that in independent schools there might be less pressure, because it's often the perception is they're under much more pressure to academically perform, but actually there may be in the state schools a greater assessment.
I don't think I can comment on that.
No.
I think that certainly in terms of the pressure on schools, not so much pressure on children, but on the pressure on schools to get good results, certainly schools in the mainstream sector, there is a pressure to perform. All schools want to do well in the league tables. It's important to them. It's important to Ofsted. I think there's a case to argue that perhaps there is more pressure there. But I think I need to be careful that I don't say anything that's going to land me in hot water.
Thank you. Ben, just one last question before we let you go. Do assessments evolve as, you know, with the years, and do they take into consideration changes in children's development? I mean, are they regularly being updated? And, for example, I have heard just this week that they're talking about bringing a new assessment for 4-year-olds.
Yeah.
Well, is it likely that will actually come to fruition? And what do you think about it? Is it a good thing to start at 4 already making, you know, judgments on children's ability?
Okay. Well, there's several things there. I think the first part of your question was about whether they evolve with children's age. And I would say that yes, in the system that we have at the moment, assessment is designed in a way which is age appropriate. So for example, for children in the foundation stage, those children won't realize they're being assessed. You know, it's entirely their teachers observing them, maybe asking them questions, interacting with them, but those children aren't going to think I'm being assessed. As far as they're concerned, they're just interacting in a normal way. As children get older, the approach to assessment does become a little bit more structured, a little bit more formal, until we get things like timed tests. Now, as regards the news item about tests for 4-year-olds, we don't know this for absolute certain yet, but it does seem very likely that this is going to be introduced. If it is introduced, it will probably start in September of 2016. That would be my best guess. And we don't yet know, though, if it is introduced, we don't yet know what kind of format it will take. My personal view, I would hope that it is a very age-appropriate form of assessment, taking into account that, 4-year-old children, it's quite difficult to assess a 4-year-old child's understanding. They don't necessarily understand formal testing in the way that a much older child would be. So I think those tests, if they do come in, they will need to be structured, I think, very carefully if they're going to produce meaningful data. The purpose, the reason the DfE is talking about bringing those tests in, is because it wants to establish a baseline so that they know whereabouts a child was at the start of primary school, which they'll then be able to compare with their test outcomes at the end of primary school. So what they'll have there is a measure of progress. They can say, when you were 4, this was your level of achievement. When you were 11, this is your level of achievement. So this is your amount of progress. So that's the reason behind it. But I do think, until we know some clear details, until the DfE make a definite statement about this, it's difficult to say any more about that, but I would hope that it's going to be an age-appropriate form of assessment rather than too narrow and too formal a test.
Ben, thank you so much. That's hugely informative for us
We've
parents.
We've kept you for ages because you've been so fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thanks. You're very welcome.
All the best.
Thanks.
Thanks a million. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Parent Show on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM. Now, we're joined on the line by David Weston, who is the Chief Executive of the Teachers Development Trust, Teacher Development Trust, I beg your pardon. David, thanks for joining us this evening.
No problem at all. Hello, Cathy. Hello, Lydia.
Hello. David, can we just quickly get your response to what you've heard tonight before we bombard you with more questions?
Well, I think Ben's given you a really good description of all the different sorts of assessment that children will get, particularly at primary school. I think it can be a very worrying thing for parents, but actually, ultimately, most of the assessment there serves lots of different purposes, and it's very easy to get confused between them. So, but I have to say, I mean, Ben's given you such a lot of interesting information already. I think it's been brilliant.
And David, can we do assessments actually mean more paperwork to teachers for the most part, or are they a valuable resource?
Well, so I mean, as I was just saying, really, I think assessments are there for multiple things. So the first reason for assessments is that children understand how far have I come and what do I need to do next. The next reason is obviously for teachers, so they can understand what are the children's needs, what are the children's strengths. You then move up a level and you've got school leaders and school governors checking that all the classes are being taught properly and seeing if any teachers or children need any extra special support. And then up at the next level, you've got local authorities using the same assessment data, and they're trying to check which schools are working really well. And if there are schools working not so well, how can we put them in touch with those schools and give some schools extra support?
Now, David, that all sounds rosy, but even we have heard anecdotally that teachers are leaving the profession because they're sick to death of having to do assessments, and they've no time for teaching because they've got 35 kids in the class and they're meant to assess every one of them individually.
So I think sometimes the problem comes when, rather than teachers being allowed to do what's best for children, teachers are trying to satisfy all the people who are watching them. So in a really great school, everything the teacher does will be there to help the children learn and help them overcome any misconceptions and help them really enjoy their learning as well. If you get a school that maybe is struggling, then sometimes what they're going to do is in an attempt to improve the teaching, they'll try and make sure the teachers are sort of ticking lots of boxes in their teaching. So, you know, we want to see them marking at a certain frequency, and we want to see certain sorts of comments and so on. So I think some teachers probably find when they've got, when they're in schools where they're not being supported enough, then actually, yes, they're being given lots of tasks which aren't necessarily there for the children's benefit, but are mostly there just to check up on them. And of course, that's very demoralising.
Now, we've had a teacher write to us who works in London to say she's a reception teacher. She said that there is no budget and very little time for training in terms of, you know, actually interpreting the questions they've been given to find results on.
Well, yes. I mean, teacher training varies a huge amount from school to school. In the best schools, and as you rightly said, there are lots of really fantastic schools in Hertfordshire, then what you find is that teachers work together to double check assessments. They moderate the grades that they've got, and they double check each other's work, and then they'll often go to other schools and they'll ask them to check the work and vice versa, and then they'll have someone from the local authority come in and also double check. So there is a lot of cross-checking, and people have a lot of chance to talk about it. In less effective schools, then yes, you're quite right, there will be teachers who aren't supported enough in this area, but on the whole, it's something, particularly at primary school, where teachers have had a lot of support over quite a period of time.
And if we were to be very cynical about it, David, is there a danger that schools could manipulate the data? Because, I mean, you know, kind of scoring kids low in four-year-old tests so that they can show that they've made massive progress in tests at like year three or six. Is there a potential for that to happen?
There's definitely potential for that. I mean, ultimately, it's a problem that we're using a few tests at the end of key stages, both to help the children and also to judge the quality of the teaching. And of course, it's natural that even though teachers want to help the children, if they feel under pressure and not trusted, then they're going to, maybe not even consciously, but they'll be doing things that perhaps make themselves look as well as possible, as good as possible. I think the problem is, one possibility would be we have different tests, some for children and some just to check on the school's progress, but then there'd be too many tests. So there really is a difficult balance here for any government. They obviously need to make sure that schools are performing well, but at the same time, they don't want to give too many tests to the children, and they're trying to make it helpful. So I think, to be honest, as with any piece of information in any public service that they have to report, there is always a danger. And again, the best schools don't play the game, and the worst schools do.
Yeah, and is there, I mean, how do we compare with our with other European countries, or is there best practice that we could be emulating?
Well, it's very interesting that we can compare the performance of England with the performance of Wales, which has quite an independent education system. And quite a few years ago now, Wales decided they were going to get rid of a lot of league tables and they weren't going to publish inspection judgments quite so publicly, because they thought that will stop teachers from sort of gaming the system. And it was a really interesting experiment to see what happened in the two countries. Actually, what ended up happening is after a few years, the big international tests of different countries, the PISA tests, the Welsh scores started dropping while the English scores stayed about the same. So it's, I think it would be fair to say that the English system, the children in the English system have done a little bit better. Now, whether that's just because there is some pressure from some league tables and Ofsted, etc., may be difficult to say, because there are negative effects of all those pressures. But as I say, it's a balance. In other countries, you find there is much, much less pressure. In other countries, for example, in the United States, there's much, much more pressure on even narrower tests. So there really is a spectrum across the world.
And how do we compare it to America?
Broadly speaking, our education system is about the same as the American education system. Interestingly, if you look at different regions in England, then the best performing region by a very long way is London. And if London was a country by itself, it would be one of the best performing countries in the world, because for various reasons, and a lot of people are trying to find out why that is. There are also some areas of the country which really don't perform well. I mean, it has to be said, Hertfordshire as an authority is doing really quite well, although there are a lot of London authorities that are doing better.
David, the perception is that when I've spoken to teachers who work in London, often they have many, many children with English not as a first language in their classroom, for example. Surely those children suffer or discriminated against broadly in those kinds of assessments?
Well, I mean, that is a very interesting question, because, of course, in order to be able to do well in the test, which is supposed to be a test of your knowledge of a particular area, you need to be able to read the questions. And, you know, that's an absolutely vital and vitally important element. What we actually find is that across the country, children who have English as an additional language, where perhaps it's not their first language they speak at home, broadly do exceedingly well. And in fact, some children from some backgrounds do significantly better than children whose parents speak English natively. Now, it's very interesting, because actually what we see is that these children acquire language early on, particularly in those schools that work on it. And actually, sometimes it's later on where some perhaps more subtle language problems from children who are native speakers or grew up in families who speak English in the home, then actually there are more subtle problems that get missed. And actually, some of the best secondaries are now having to pick up on some of those vocabulary and spoken English issues when they arrive in year seven.
Very interesting. And do you have a view on the gifted and talented label? Is that a help? Again, the schools seem to have assessed our children at secondary level as gifted and talented in certain things. We've done a show on this before, and they get a letter through saying they're gifted and talented in maths or whatever. It seems like the process is in place to sort of promote, you know, success and aspiration may actually be labelling and damaging children in some way. What's your view on that?
It's a very complicated issue. The gifted and talented programs were brought in to make sure that every child is really stretched. The problem you've got with all the league tables and inspection is what people often do is look at the children who are really struggling and make schools really focus on them. So there was a worry that schools were neglecting the children at the top and not stretching them as much as they could do. So they brought in gifted and talented programs. Now, I think the problem is, you know, the phrase gifted and talented is very difficult to define. They went for an easy definition, but it was a certain portion of sort of students in rank order from every single school. But of course, different schools with different intakes and depending on the assessment they use would have chosen really different children, and it's very difficult to compare. You're also quite right that actually, if you tell a child that they're talented, what that often does is actually demotivate them. Because what happens is they say, well, if I'm very talented, then I ought to be able to do well on this. And actually, if there's something I think I'm not going to do well on, I'm not going to do it because I might lose that lovely label that I'm proud of. And actually, in educational psychology terms, a lot of teachers and schools are now really focusing on telling children you're a really hard worker rather than you're clever or talented. So it can be damaging. At the same time, it was very well-meaning in order to make sure every child is stretched to the maximum amount that they can be.
I can see exactly what you're saying, David. I mean, just from the kids around me that I know, I can't imagine it being helpful. I can't imagine it being help. I can imagine it being demotivating to the child, to the children around the child who's selected, or, you know, and I can't see it bringing out anything more in a child apart. I mean, I think the only person that should know is perhaps the parents, but certainly the teachers, and they should know how to draw out the best out of the children. But like, I could imagine it being quite a divisive label and not very helpful to the children themselves.
If your friend is labelled gifted and talented, I mean, it makes you feel so depressed.
And the level of maturity that would require of a child not to just kind of dance on the table and kind of go, I'm gifted,
I'm
talented.
Well, the other one's given up because a friend has been labelled as gifted.
Yeah. Yeah.
But interestingly, there are negative effects on that child who has been labelled that way, because they suddenly take fewer risks. They might work less hard because they think, well, I either don't need to work hard, or if I do have to work hard, maybe I'm no longer talented. So it can be difficult. However, at the same time, what we don't want is children who are bored, who are always waiting for other children, who don't feel they're being engaged and being made to think as hard as they should do. I mean, ultimately, these labels are probably not so helpful, and what we really need to do is make sure every child is able to develop to their own potential. But schools do need to make sure, in their minds, they need to make sure, are we stretching the top end as much as we can do? Whether you do that through what you label a gifted and talented program, I'm not sure. But there certainly should be opportunities for children who are moving very quickly to continue to move and be stretched.
And David, one other question. If you feel that your child hasn't been rightly assessed, if you kind of feel like, you know, the year some assessment took place, his teacher didn't particularly like him or her teacher didn't particularly like him and they didn't bring out the best of them, but they flourished afterwards. I mean, is there a chance to kind of break a negative image that your school might have of your child? Or, you know, is there any way to undo the damage of assessments if you feel they're not particularly accurate?
Well, I think the first thing to do in the home is to be as positive as possible. But when you make sure you're always talking about what your child is doing and really praise them for working really hard. Obviously, if you think the school isn't drawing out their potential as much as they could do, then the best thing to do would be arrange an appointment and have a conversation with the school. I mean, schools have to, again, take a sort of a practical view. They don't want to assess them too often, and so they'll use only certain bits of information when they're deciding perhaps what set a child is in or what tasks they'll be given. But there should be a flexibility in that. However, from the school point of view, having been on the other side, what you sometimes get is, unfortunately, some parents who are always saying, my child should be in a higher set, when maybe that's not the case. So it is quite difficult for schools sometimes. However, I would say to parents, if you enter a very open sort of dialogue and say, well, how can I help my child move forward, and what do they need to do in order perhaps to be put up a set or in order to go on to the slightly harder tasks? I think that's the best way to have that discussion.
And I love the idea of doing that. I think the only worry that's in my head, or I think many parents' head, is that you absolutely don't want to be labelled a pushy parent, and you don't want to go in there kind of going, I think you've got my Johnny wrong, I think he's a genius, and I think, you know, it's very hard to get the balance of that right and, you know, not come across as a pushy parent. Have you got any tips for us how to sound like that?
I mean, in a sense, you want to be just pushy enough. I think there is an interesting piece of psychology that actually sometimes people think that their child is in a set, they could be in a higher set. But actually, psychologically speaking, sometimes children who are at the top of a slightly lower set, the way they feel about themselves and the way they compare themselves to other children in that set, that can actually give them an advantage over being in the set above when they're struggling, and then suddenly their self-image is a little bit lower. So actually having that sense that, look, I'm quite a successful child within this set, that can actually, it's not actually as bad as you might think. So I wouldn't automatically just assume that if there's any chance a child can move up, then they should do. I think the other thing is also, in most schools, they'll be attempting to teach these children as much as they can. They're under a lot of pressure for every child to reach their potential. So if they think there's a way that you know, your child can do a little bit better than they're doing now, they're probably going to be reasonably open to it. I think it's all in the tone of how you have the conversation. And, you know, if you have it politely and calmly and constructively and ask how you can help, then I think the vast majority of schools would be only too happy to have that conversation.
David, I think we've got a tweet that's just come in.
That's right, from Mike McSharry. He said, I think all children are gifted. Talented teachers find out where the kids' gifts are. Thank you for that, Mike.
And Dave, we've got another question here that's just been tweeted about choosing a school, because you've made people think about, well, when we actually go in and look at these secondary schools, should we be asking about the way they sort of, you know, deal with children, who, how they label children or how they bring them on or what their sort of attitude is to assessment? Are there key questions that we could be sort of going in with from the beginning that are important to sort of hear the response to?
Well, I think a great question to ask a school is, do you have information on how children who have different sorts of abilities did at the end, for example? So if you're asking in a primary school, what you see is that no matter where the children started when they entered the primary school, all of those children achieved really well and actually they were brought up to a great level. I mean, in a sense, different schools will always have different ethoses. Some will be a little bit more competitive, some might be a little less competitive. And essentially, that's where there is this element of some parental choice. The interesting thing is, when you actually look at some of the statistics, that the school you choose for your child has much less effect than. And when you look at sort of the national data tables, then children from who got the same test scores, for example, in their Key Stage 2 SATs, then even if they went to sort of a school in the top 20% or a school in the bottom 20%, the difference it makes might be in only a few of their GCSEs by a single grade, and not sort of the difference between getting all A's or getting all E's.
So what, in your view, is makes the big difference in children's attainment? What's the big factor?
Sometimes the biggest factor is actually the individual teacher that they get within the school. But in all honesty, the biggest factor that affects attainment is actually the way that they were brought up, whether they're surrounded in an environment where they're always hearing words and discussion, they've got lots of opportunities to talk and interact, where they're constantly thinking about numbers and figures, and really they're surrounded by a really rich environment where there are lots of words and numbers, and they can see people around them who work hard to get where they get, rather than people who, you know, give up easily or who get angry too quickly, or where they're in families, for example, where they don't get the opportunity to talk and contribute and read and get into discussions. So I think really the most important thing that parents can do is just make sure they're giving their child that really rich experience.
David, as always, such valuable insights. Thank you so much for joining us on the Parent Show this evening. And we've had a couple of comments on Twitter. Intelligence is working hard to get better. Kerry Thomas said, in Wales, it's more able and talented rather than gifted and talented. And we also have from TWDL Learning, effort putter inners would be better. Gifted implies they're naturally intelligent and no one is. There you go.
Absolutely.
There you go. David Weston from the Teacher Development Trust, thanks a million for joining us.
Thank you very much.
All the best.
Neave Solicitors are proud to sponsor the Parent Show. The friendly team at Neave's includes specialists who can guide you through all the legal ups and downs of family life. Visit neavesolicitors.co.uk. Neave Solicitors, your complete legal solution.